KZSU-FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today, I'm very excited to have on the show the author of a book that is coming out this month in October called The Future of Reputation. And the focus of the book is literally, and the subtitle of the book is Gossip, Rumor, and Privacy on the Internet, a topic that we've discussed at some length on Hearsay Culture with a number of guests, indeed Lauren Gelman, my colleague at CIS, among others, and Chris Hufnagel, who was at Epic and is now at Berkeley, and others have really taken a close look at privacy issues. And with Professor Sala's book, we have a study of, and really an extension of this analysis, where we're figuring out what exactly the Internet's doing in terms of this very clear tension between privacy rights and free speech. And it's a fascinating area that really warrants a lot of close discussion, and that's why today we're going to try to delve into some of those issues. Professor Sala, by way of background, is an associate professor of law at George Washington University Law School. He's the author of a couple of well-known books, in the IT generally field as well as a law field, Digital Person, Technology and Privacy in the Information Age from 2004, and Information Privacy Law, which is a textbook that Aspen puts out, and indeed it's a book that I might be using if I teach a seminar in privacy down the road, which I might like to do. Professor Sala is an internationally known expert in privacy law, has been interviewed all over the place, and as well has published over 25 articles in law reviews. So he's very well situated to have this discussion. And indeed, I'm a big fan of Digital Person. It's a book, actually, that I would interview Professor Sullivan. However, he has a new book coming out, which makes it a lot more timely and also makes it something that we can discuss in more detail and see where we are today. So Professor Sullivan was kind enough to give me proofs of the book, so I was able to take a really good look at it for purposes of this interview. And indeed, when we look at issues of privacy, a lot of different concerns come up. One concern, of course, is the free speech issue, the idea of what is newsworthy, what is appropriate for public dissemination. But of course, as Professor Sala focuses on with regard to the Internet, there's a permanence issue. Not only can the Internet disseminate information rapidly and very quickly and without much editorial content or editorial review, but merely here is the info, but it also has a level of permanence, so that once something is on the Internet, quote-unquote, it is publicly available for all to see ad infinitum. And indeed, in the introduction to Professor Sala's book, he references the famous Nathaniel Hawthorne Scarlet Letter, where Hester Prynne carried the Scarlet A to represent her sin of adultery. And he analogizes there, and it's a good way to start the conversation in a few minutes, with the Internet by saying that the Scarlet Letter is now in digital form, what he calls an indelible record of people's past misdeeds. And he quotes a commentator regarding a story which is affectionately known as the Dog Poop Girl, that we might use as a way to introduce this topic. A commentator talking about that issue said, right or wrong, the Internet is a cruel historian. And that cruel historian is indeed what we're going to focus on today. The question really being, is that cruel historian doing the job properly? Is the cruel historian of the Internet something that we can effectively administer and also perhaps regulate? And what does privacy law and free speech say about those issues? So we're going to take a very short music break here on Hearsay Culture. And when we come back, we're going to start the conversation with Professor Dan Sullivan, author of the book, The Future of Reputation, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Okay, we're back, and if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the line is Professor Sullivan. Dan, are you there?
I am here.
Thank you so much for joining me in Hearsay Culture, and thanks for your patience as I continue to be home engineer recording here in Charlotte. So thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Let's start off with kind of a background question for listeners that may not be familiar. I discussed your background very briefly, but perhaps you could tell us, how did you come to be interested in these topics?
Well, broadly, privacy was a topic that went back to my days in law school, which was when the Internet was sort of the commercial Internet, the Internet cause struggle and understanding and dealing with it. And that's what I thought I'd like to make my career about. And I got into the issue of privacy and started writing and reading and thinking about it, and thought I'd do a whole panoply of different issues, but privacy became so rich and was so, there's so much there that I stuck with it and have been doing it now ever since. And the specific topic of this book was inspired when I started blogging back in May of 2005. I was a guest blogger on a blog, and I really enjoyed it. I really got a kick out of it. I was amazed at all the this whole world that was out there, these people communicating and talking with each other and commenting on posts, and how when you posted, it got popular on the internet, how you know, hundreds, thousands of people might read it. And as I became and started blogging and have blogged ever since, I started to encounter stories about people who were gossiping about each other, and stories about people shaming each other on the internet, and looking at, thinking about what does this mean for the future of privacy. And that question is really what sparked writing this book.
Does the question of privacy, or let me put it another way, is the question of privacy one that you focus on with particular reference to the internet and its impact, or do you have a broader scholarly agenda when you look at these topics?
Well, I guess my broader scholarly agenda is to think about privacy and the impact of technology. So those are the animating questions, the animating things that I think undergird all of my work. And I think that more specifically, the issues that I tend to focus on are ones that I think are important and interesting to me. And so those, I think, are all linked in that broader general theme, but a lot of the things I tend to write papers on or books on are things that I think are things that I am fascinated with, that I can spend a long time reading and writing and thinking about. So that's sort of what animates the specific issues that I might write on. But the general focus and the general theme I see to my work and is looking at how do we deal with a world where technology is really changing things in some amazing ways. How do we get the law, which is typically a kind of slow-moving conservative institution, to address these really dramatic changes in the way we live?
The focus of the book and the future of reputation kind of starts the conversation. Your focus here is in a particular impact of the internet, and perhaps we can start the conversation by asking the basic question, what do you mean by reputation?
Well, reputation is the collective impressions of you by others. We all have a reputation. It's what others in the community think of us. And we have reputations for different kinds of things. I have an academic reputation. People have read my work and they have a certain perception of what kind of a scholar I am, and people have, also my friends and people I know have a perception of what kind of person I am. There's reputation for a lot of different things. Reputation for my ability to pay back my loans. So my bank is interested in my financial reputation and how well I have paid off my debts in the past. And this perception of a person across these different dimensions of their life affects how others are going to deal with them, or even whether other people will deal with them. If someone has a really bad reputation, that means that a lot of people might not want to be their friend, might not want to converse with them, might not want to read their writings or their stuff, or loan them money, or invite them to be a roommate, or so on.
The focus on reputation kind of leads us into what I mentioned in the introduction, which is the analogy to the Scarlet Letter. And perhaps we can start delving into the specifics of the book by asking you, you choose that analogy among many others to introduce the book, but what about the Scarlet Letter is particularly illustrative to you here? What is the analogy that you're trying to draw?
Well, the idea of the Scarlet Letter is that it's a very public symbol that is connected to Hester Prynne in the novel The Scarlet Letter, and it results in her being ostracized from her community. It has dramatic effects on her life, and it is a badge of infamy that she's forced to wear for committing adultery and violating one of the sort of very strong norms of the society at the time that the book is set, which is colonial America. So it's I think the analogy is apt because the idea is that information that is permanently or for a very long time affixed to an individual's identity starts to have controlling effects over their lives, and it becomes very hard to escape from under that that badge of infamy, so to speak.
The other comment you use there, and it's one that's interesting to kind of set the framework, is the idea of the internet being a cruel historian. We know, and it's fairly well accepted, that especially not only with search engines that are highly sophisticated like Google, but also with resources like the Wayback Machine and others, that its permanence on the internet is a significant issue. And it intersects with privacy in kind of a somewhat dangerous way. So when we talk about the historian in the context of the internet, what are we referring to there?
Well, I'm referring to the fact that if you want to find out anything about anybody or anything, you can plug it into Google and you get a list of a whole lot of stuff, a whole lot of websites. And these can extend way back into somebody's past. So you can find out what was I doing 5-10 years ago. You might be able to find fragments of information that existed were created at that particular time, or were talking about something that happened at that time. And because you can readily find this information today, it's just literally a click away. It becomes to some extent part of my history, to the extent that someone can readily access it. If you wanted to find out in the past, before the internet, about someone's history, you might say, well, maybe they were written about newspaper articles. But how would you go about doing that kind of a search? You'd have to find out where they lived. You'd have to go to local papers. Maybe something got written about. Maybe they were a high school sports star. Maybe something got them written about in the paper. Probably, for most people, probably not. You could try to go to various places where they might have been, like go to their college, and maybe there's something in the college newspaper. But all this would be a tremendously difficult thing to do. And now the difference is you can get all that really from your own home at the click of a mouse. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, in addition to being able to access a lot of the newspapers or other little things that might be available, you can also get fragments of information from social network sites, from blogs, and a lot of information that wouldn't even be in a newspaper before. So gossip about people in high school, gossip about people in college, that is known, those rumors, that gossip, that is known to those people and was forgotten. Mm-hmm. It was held in the minds of the individuals who knew it, and you'd move away, and people would forget, and only a few college friends would actually know about it. But now, if it's on these websites, if it's on a social network website, it's on a blog, it becomes part of your Google history, and that can go wherever you go. You can go all the way over to Tasmania, and still, it's there.
Mm-hmm. Let's probe on that a little bit, because it's an interesting idea. And one of the examples that you use in introducing the book is a book, or is a story of a true story of an associate at a law firm a few years ago who erroneously sent an email pointing out the cushy lifestyle that this particular individual had at a particular law firm, and mistakenly, as the paradigmatic problem of email goes, sent it to a larger audience than that individual intended, and the result was that particular email became a subject of derision. And you point out in the book that this particular email made its way around the internet rather quickly. It was reproduced. People commented on it. There was a New Yorker article about it. And the interesting thing was, as I was doing research for today, I was able, indeed, as you pointed out in the book, I was able to find the emails, as you point out, instantly by typing in a few words and going to Google. But interestingly, and this gets to the issue of reputation, what I discovered is that this individual who had written an email, which really didn't appear to be very good for their career, was in fact hired by the firm that was the subject of the email. And so I guess I want to kind of figure out the parameters of what we mean by reputation. Are you focusing here in the book on the idea that information, as you've described, on the internet is available permanently and anywhere? Or are you going further to talk about what reputation means today in an internet culture? Because it surprised me to find that notwithstanding this email, this particular individual got their job. In other words, at least as far as their employer went, their reputation may not have changed that much.
Well, I think that it is certainly true that for a lot of things, I guess going back to your first question, I think the book is about both the sort of effects of, like, how do we live in a world where increasingly more fragments of information about our lives as we're growing up is going to be available and is going to be in this form. How does it change, to some extent, the way reputations are assessed?
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I would say that reputation after the email is not quite the same. The story ends happily. He was hired by the firm. The email is actually very, very funny and, to some extent, very apt for what a lot of summer associates do, which is eat lunches and are wined and dined by law firms.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think his case is one where the information about him is not particularly, it's slightly embarrassing, but it's not career-ending kind of gossip. And I think that, but it doesn't necessarily, could affect certain employment opportunities. It could come out to haunt him a little bit. It'll always be there. It'll always be something that folks might joke to him about. And I think that a lot of times there's information that even if it results in the same decisions, even if you're going to be hired or given a loan or the same ultimate end result happens, it's still something that follows you around that you might not want to have followed around.
Mm-hmm.
It's still something that people might use when they're judging you and making the first impression of you as a person, and it's something where that might not be what you want people to think about. If someone in their past was a party animal in college, there's nothing inherently wrong with living it up at college. A lot of people did, but that's not sort of what they want to be known for.
Right.
They don't want to be the poster person for college party animal. And oftentimes that's what happens when information really becomes sticky and someone really, he is now the poster child for lazy summer associate.
Mm-hmm.
Something that he may or may not like. Some people actually embrace the information that that could be potentially embarrassing that gets out about them on the internet. Some people don't. Some people find it deeply troubling and really have a tough time with it. It's very hard to, in a lot of cases, know what the effects are going to be on the person and what is going to happen in terms of how people judge them and how that affects who they want to be. Because there's this tension with reputation, and that is, reputation is not entirely ours. We often speak of reputation as if it's our possession, but it's really the impressions about us that others have. It's something that others give to us. It's the way they see us, and we want some control over that because it's really hard, to live with a bad reputation. Everyone wants to be perceived in a particular manner. And it's something that we only have a very small amount of control over.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is there's this tension about how much control, should people have over their reputations? How much control do we want to allow people to have in this arena? And the only bit of control that we have over this is I can't go and change the way you think about me. I can't go into your mind and change that. I can try to do new things to give you more information to reassess me. The other thing I can do is try to keep information out of the public sphere so that you don't know certain things or can't use certain things to judge me. And that's what a lot of people do. They don't tell everybody their entire life histories and every dimension of their life. And then if they meet them, you meet someone, you
woman, my colleague,
only a part of that person. And then you make your judgment based on that part of that person. So a person can change who they were. They might have been a scoundrel in their youth and decided to reform themselves and become a nice person, and they go to a different community, and in that community, they're this new person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what the internet is threatening to do is make that tougher, make it really tougher to escape the past, to become a new person, to have a new start or a second chance.
It's a fascinating area, and the book does, I think, a wonderful job in spelling out the problems inherent here in stories that do seem to be innocuous on their surface, but as you point out, can have larger repercussions than might be evident. And there's an interesting distinction, that one can draw in going through the various stories that you tell about particular instances that have happened. And in one instance, you have the blogger, and you talk about bloggers in the book that, people on Facebook and what have you, or just bloggers generally, who share intimate details about themselves knowingly. And that information then is used against them in employment situations or just reputationally generally. But then you also talk about on the other hand, individuals like the famous and really sad story of the Star Wars kid, individuals who, unbeknownst to them, had information that they thought might be private or should be kept private, perhaps, made public through, what amounts to jokes or really just thoughtlessness. And so judgment seems to come into this analysis. And I guess I'm wondering how, in your view, the internet changes the role of simply a human being's judgment. In other words, holding them responsible for what they do or what they choose to do and the risks that they take.
I think there's two sides to this, because with the information that's about people, I mean, we have to assess each other's reputations. And so I might want to keep information from you about judging me, but you ultimately want as much information as you can to make a judgment about me. And when we withhold or allow people to withhold information about their reputations, to some extent, we're depriving others of information that might be helpful in judging them. And there's also the issue of accountability, that if people were not, people could always just readily escape everything that they did, had a memory, a short-term memory, and would forget everything in the past all the time. People could just do things without accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I could be, do something really nasty and horrible today, and if I knew everyone was going to forget about it or I could get away with it and it would never affect my reputation, then people might do that kind of thing more often. And so accountability can be a great thing. It's what keeps people in line, it keeps people following norms, what stops people from being rude. And when you take away that accountability and what people do then becomes part of the reputations, it makes them think more about, maybe I shouldn't be rude, maybe I shouldn't do this, because it is going to affect how people think of me and my standing in the community, and I won't do those things. And I think that's great. I think actually it's really important that people are accountable. And the difficult thing is, how do we modulate that? Because 100% accountability or too much accountability can be a bad thing, but also too much non-accountability can be a bad thing. And so it's establishing the right balance. And that's the difficult thing here, because I don't think you can go one way or the other. I do think increasingly we have these two types of situations with information about people getting on the net. One is the information about people unwittingly getting on the internet without their consent. So someone blogs about you and writes about gossip about you, and you didn't want that on, and they put this information up, is a little bit different from you yourself spilling out your personal details on a blog.
Mm-hmm.
The first case, I think we can do a bit more about in the law to redress that, because someone has wronged you by putting this information, this gossip about you on the internet. I think we can... the law is more able to address that situation than it is to do what about you. You know, I don't believe the law should tell you, no, you can't say whatever you want to say about yourself on the internet. If someone wants to spill their most intimate secrets online, I think that they should be able to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what makes it tricky in a lot of cases is when you're spilling your intimate secrets online, a lot of people's intimate secrets are not what they do in isolation, but they involve their friends, their family, and other people who are often involved in their lives. So when they're spilling their own personal information, they also might be spilling personal information about a lot of other people who don't want that information out there. And the second problem is that a lot of people who are doing this are very young.
Mm-hmm.
And someone who is 16 might not be thinking about how this information will affect them when they're 30.
And that actually leads me into another area that I want to discuss after the break. So we're going to take a very short break here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. We're chatting with Professor Dan Solov, author of the book The Future of Reputation. So let's take a short break now, and then when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We're back on Hearsay Culture, and before we continue the conversation, now's the time on the show where I ask you for money. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you in order to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can go to underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, the email address, and you will get a response. And hopefully, at that point, if you're considering making a donation, your donation will be warmly accepted. So we're back with Professor Dan Solov. And Dan, in the remaining portion of our show, you were starting to talk about what the law can and can't do. And perhaps a good way to kind of get into that is what you talk about in the book about the vices of internet shaming, and particularly the lack of proportionality in punishment. We know the basic concept that punishments should fit the crime, but you take a view in the book that the punishments here are not really proportional to what's happening. So maybe you could explain how the law intersects with that.
Exactly. Well, I think some of the, a bit about punishment is, you know, someone like the dog group girl, which is a woman who had a small dog on a train. This happened in Korea. The dog pooped on the train. The woman didn't clean up the poop. Someone took a picture, puts it online, and everybody across the internet starts putting up personal information about her, starts trying to organize campaigns to harass her, starts taking her picture and morphing it into other images, and millions of people are starting to find out about her, and this now becomes what she's known for. She is forever the dog girl. She certainly did a bad infraction. I mean, it's very rude what she did. She should have picked up after her dog. But is this punishment too great? Should she be forever branded with this infraction? Now, I don't know if it's going to actually affect whether or not she will be employable or not or whatever, but it is something that who wants to live the rest of their days constantly with this badge of infamy hanging over them? That's something that you do something rude, the people there tell you off or give you an angry scowl, but that's about it. And maybe that's what that infraction deserves, but does it deserve being vilified as a worldwide villain? And I think that oftentimes these instances of shaming spiral out of control. What starts out as an impulse by people to basically enforce social order, to get people to behave, to be not rude, to create a more orderly and courteous society actually defeats that very purpose, that when these things become mob-like behavior, and once something really gets legs and the story gets interesting, everybody loves to just pile on, mm-hmm. and the attacks get more vicious, the language, the things being done become ruder and nastier, and a lot of these things I just don't think end very prettily. And to some extent, they're almost more disorder, that they're taking what would ordinarily be something that the law or society might deal with in a way that's with due process to make sure the person who was shamed actually did the bad deed, that finds out the other side of the story. These are the things that we've established in society to sort of avert mob justice. Mob justice doesn't listen to the other side. Mob justice just acts, and it often acts before it truly knows the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're bringing back, and I think that's a problem.
Is it
controlling that behavior is very, very tricky. Because once something gets out, and once something just starts happening, it's really, really, really hard to do anything to kind of stop one of these viral tsunamis of sorts, to mix metaphors. Once something becomes really sticky on the internet, it just becomes out of control.
Do you think we're talking about are we talking about a modern Oxbow incident type situation? Because what we have here, and to push back a little bit on that, I certainly take your point, is as you talk about in the book, this particular individual, this dog poop girl, did in fact do this in a public sphere. And you point out this issue, and you point in fact the comments where people said, well, it doesn't matter whether one person or a million people see it, this was public, and they didn't have a right, therefore, to expect it to be kept private. And while that does seem harsh, isn't it not at least a plausible argument? That what we're talking about here is the internet merely amplifying the distribution of information that in and of itself is not good for one's reputation. So that ultimately, aren't we in this line of analysis saying to individuals, well, what you did from a moral perspective was bad, but you know what, we're now going to figure out, and I guess that's the question that I'm asking you, are we now trying to figure out what the appropriate level of consternation and knowledge about one's particular behavior that we might morally or otherwise find offensive should be?
Yes, I think that's it. It's finding the right kind of balance, because I think the internet has thrown a balance out of whack to some extent. I think we did have mechanisms. We had gossip. We had shame. these things have existed since time immemorial. So we've always shamed and we've always gossiped about people and we've always done these things. But when they go to the internet, I think they're amplified in certain ways and they take on different effects. Something that was temporary becomes permanent. Something that was minor and only involved a few people now can be done by billions. And I think when we change the nature and effects of this, we have to think about, well, is this how we want it to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we don't want the dog poop girl to escape, to just be able to do this and have no consequences. On the other hand, I think that what happened to her was extreme for this kind of infraction. And I think that the middle ground consequences are what the internet is supplanted. And I think that's the question that I think makes this so complicated. As far as the first thing that you mentioned, which is, well, she's in a public place after all.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the internet gossip that gets out is in fact public. Some of it's private. Some could be, an angry ex have pictures of their ex in the nude and post them online, or people tell stories that only one or two other people know versus what the dog poop girl did, which is something that happened in public. I do think that our notions of privacy don't adequately recognize privacy in public to some extent. And I'm not saying that what she did should be purely private. And this is one of the difficulties with the way we currently understand privacy, and that we understand it in a very binary way. We see privacy as either private or it's public. If it's private, it means you're entitled to keep it completely hidden and confidential and secret. If it's public, it's fair game, it goes out to the world. But we really live our lives, most of the spaces that we occupy in the world and in our activities are never purely private. There are these places that are, to some extent, mixed public and private places. An example is a restaurant. I'm talking to a few people on my table at a restaurant. I'm in public, but I'm not expecting everyone else in the restaurant to hear my conversation. I'm not expecting that conversation to be broadcast on the internet. If you're in a gym locker room, you're actually in a place where any member of the gym can walk into the locker room, but you're not expecting that to get out to the world. And I think there are a lot of these places which are in this gray area between public and private. They're not purely private, but they're not purely public. And that, this binary distinction between public and private is, it just doesn't work for our world. And what's really pushing at this distinction and really making it really problematic is the fact that it's so easy today to capture information.
Mm-hmm.
That anyone can use a cell phone camera, anyone can record, anyone can capture data and display it to the world in an instant. And so it's easier to get data from these places and capture it, and it's also easier now to disseminate it. If I overheard someone's conversation in a restaurant that I found interesting, and it was 30 years ago, unless I was a member of the mainstream media, it'd be very, very hard for me to actually disseminate that beyond a circle of friends that I have to say, hey, you know, isn't this funny? This is what I heard. I saw so-and-so in the restaurant. He said X. Now, anyone can readily do that and disseminate it to everybody in the world. And that's, I think, a difference. In addition to the greater ease with which we can capture information, and that now people running around with cameras. Everyone has a camera on their cell phone, or a lot of people do. So it's much, much, and I think that's just going to increase as time goes on. There's more and more surveillance camera footage. As the cell phone cameras get better and people have video capability to record video and so on and so forth, the ability to capture information at sort of all these places, which we originally were in this gray zone between public and private, is going to become increasingly easier. And I think that destroys the nature of these places. I want to be able to have a conversation at a restaurant and talk about personal things that I don't want the entire world to know. I want there to be a distinction distinction between what I say when I'm chatting with a few friends walking down the street. I don't want that to be seen as the same as if I broadcast it on national television.
The one of the challenges here, and I think it's an interesting one to explore in about the last 10 or so minutes that we have in our discussion, is the issue of what controls we really can have on the dissemination of information. You talk about copyright and privacy as ways of controlling information, and that's an area that, of course, I focused on, and indeed the Center for Internet Society is focused on, by way of Professor Lessig's work and others. And we see that there is a way for the law to do this controlling. And yet, we're not talking about information that necessarily or would be copyrightable. In other words, that conversation that you have at dinner in a restaurant is not necessarily a copyright. It's more just a matter of your basic expectation as you describe it to privacy in that intimate conversation. So, turning back to the internet and the law, is the internet really an instrumentality of this larger problem, or do you see the internet itself as being that code is law issue that Professor Lessig and others have written about?
Well, I think that the internet is one dimension of the problem, and it's certainly not the only problem. I think it is a wonderful new technology that people are using that is changing the way that we're distributing information, the way that we're disseminating information. I mean, there's other technologies that also feed into it in that the internet is a way to distribute the information, but there's also new and better ways to capture that information. So I think we're dealing with a variety of technologies that are intersecting, with the internet being, I think, the hub of them, which are affecting the way that we engage in these long-term practices of gossip and shaming, and are changing the nature of that, and changing the nature of the way we live in real space.
You mentioned, and I would be remiss not to go there in the remaining few minutes. What ultimately do you see is the balance that needs to be struck, and how do we go about attempting to achieve that balance?
That is, I think, the million-dollar question, and that's the thing I really struggled with in writing this book, is what can the law do? I start with the big bird's-eye view of the law and look at three different approaches to the law, very, very broadly, without the specifics, just three different approaches the law might do. One approach is a libertarian approach. And the libertarian approach would be hands-off. And this is a very kind of pro-free speech view. It's a view that I see often very, very popular with internet communities, which is we really don't want to stifle free speech. There's very little that can be done. We should kind of leave hands-off of it. That could be one approach. The problem with that is it's basically doing nothing about the problem or doing nothing to protect privacy. And I think that the thumb is too heavily on the side of free speech. And ultimately, I think that if we go that route, there's some dangers. And I think one of the dangers is that in society, in every society, there's got to be a mechanism for people to vindicate their reputations, for people who to protect their reputations. People are going to find a way to do this. It's too important to people to have no protection over this. And so I think that then the people used to duel and used to fight. And if the law supplanted these things as a way to protect people, if we take that away, if we make it impossible for people to protect themselves in that way, there's going to be some outlet. People are going to find some outlet to do that. And I think we want to keep a more socially orderly outlet like the law rather than other things. The other thing that I would say is, that's one approach, libertarian approach. I don't think that works because it's not really doing anything to address the problem. The other one is authoritarian approach, which are people who advocate, we should restrict blogging in schools, we shouldn't allow people to use social networks in schools. We should ban people from doing these kind of things. And I don't think that's really a viable approach either. It's something that really does not, it's just inconsistent with the First Amendment in a lot of cases. And I think it's way too restrictive. I think that people should be blogging and I think using social networks. I don't think there's anything inherently bad about these technologies. There's a lot of good things about them. I enjoy blogging. I think that someone in high school can learn a lot by blogging and by expressing themselves. And I think it's good that people are writing and expressing their feelings. So I think that set of responses from the law is not a good set of responses. And so that leaves the middle ground. That leaves somewhere in between. And that's where I suggest that the law needs to figure out a way to get people to resolve these problems. If someone gossips about somebody, the law needs to try to nip it in the bud. How can we get them? Someone finds out that there's this information that is about their private lives that someone posted about them. They should be able to ask that person to take it down. And if that person doesn't take it down, they should have some recourse to be able to have the law help them take it down. Now, one of the problems in the law currently is that the law is not, because of, I think, a very narrow understanding of privacy, and because of a lot of other considerations, I think the law is not particularly adept at doing that. So typically what happens is the law is almost impotent when it comes to a lot of these situations. And I think that by strengthening the law a little bit and by broadening our understanding of privacy and by understanding better a balance between privacy and free speech, we can tweak the law so that it actually can respond to these situations a bit more and give people who are hurt by this a little more power to be able to do something about it.
Yeah, you talk about in the book, you talk about the refurbishing, as you call it, the appropriation tort, or the misappropriation of name and likeness. And it seems like, from the description of the problem that you've identified, that would be a good way and a clear way to get at this issue, at least from the standpoint of allowing for the assessment of damages through a court procedure for those that find that, in fact, the misappropriation has occurred.
Yeah, although what I want to ultimately do, like basically the appropriation tort allows you to protect your name or likeness. So when I take a photograph of you, ordinarily, like copyright, will give me, the taker of the photograph, this really broad set of protections. You can't take that photograph and then put it on your website and use that photograph in certain ways, sell that photograph, do certain things with it, because I have this copyright protection over that photograph that I took. Yet when it comes to privacy, we have this appropriation tort that protects the person whose photograph was taken. But that protection is much, much lesser than what the copyright gives you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not arguing that we should give the full copyright protections. I find a lot of problems with copyright. I think it's far too excessive in a lot of certain areas. But it does illustrate that the law can attempt to recognize greater rights of control over certain things. And it chooses to recognize greater rights when it comes to the kind of rectifying someone's financial interests in their creations, and much, much less concern when it comes to vindicating their reputation or their privacy. And I think that shift in, we need a shift in values and a more of a recognition of people's privacy and reputation there. Even if we refurbish the tort, I think that there's another problem with the law, is that I don't want to see a rush to the courthouse where everyone's filing complaints
right.
and litigating these things. I think that ultimately, in a lot of cases, litigation hurts both sides more than it helps.
Well, it certainly disseminates information as well.
Exactly. It disseminates more information. It also is a tremendously costly because lawyers add so much to the cost. It takes up time. It takes up effort. So the idea is trying to divide the system where we keep the law out of it as much as possible, yet the law tries to spark or encourage people to negotiate and to try to solve these things. Now, there are certain situations where they're just so bad, the damage is done, there's very little that can be done informally with the parties working it out. And those are situations where I think that's where the law should be involved, that's where we should have a lawsuit.
I think
in a lot of situations, I think we can address and solve these problems without a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And so then, in my book, I propose a way that we can keep the law as a threat, yet try to keep it at bay and try to prevent a whole litany of lawsuits when there really shouldn't be many. So we want the law to encourage people to solve their problems and to work them out, to give them an incentive. If you don't do this, you know, you have this alternative and it's bad, so you better work it out. Currently, I think one of the problems is that the law, because it's not protective enough in this area, there's no incentive for people to work it out. And in a lot of cases, someone can just say, no, your private information's up there on my site. I don't care. I don't have to do anything. And in a lot of circumstances, they're right. They don't have to do anything because the law, I think, overprotects speech in certain cases.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's a problem which is massive, and I think your book treats the issue very well, and I think in a rather balanced way. And unfortunately, because of the nature of a radio interview, we've run out of time, and I want to at least give you the opportunity to say, you know, to the extent that people are interested in learning more about these issues, your book is available, and are there other places or other sites you might recommend?
Yes. Well, I have a blog. I blog at concurrentopinions.com, and I often blog on stories like this and on privacy more generally. And so you can see me write about the news of the day and other things at the blog. The other thing is there's a website for the book, which has more information about the book and has reviews and links and other things like that. The website is called futureofreputation.com. Which is basically just part of the title of my book. So futureofreputation.com, you can find out a lot more information about the book.
Dan, thank you so much for joining me today, discussing your book and really delving into these issues. And I know it's tip of the iceberg, but thank you for coming on. And I certainly invite you back in the future as we see, as we further explore, and perhaps hopefully there's some impact from your book in thinking about how the law should treat these issues. So thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I want to thank Professor Dan Soliv for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, a fascinating book, The Future of Reputation. I'm going to have several other authors on in the coming weeks. Dean John Garin from Hamline University has written a book very different in focus than Professor Soliv's book, and the book is literally called Own It, The Law and Business Guide to Launching a New Business Through Innovation, Exclusivity, and Relevance. And I will tell you that Professor Dean Garin's book focuses in an area of law that I'm particularly interested in, and he certainly takes different conclusions with regard to how the law should be operating and how it is operating than I would, and so that should be a fun discussion. As well, I'm going to have Alex Wright on, the author of the book Glut, Mastering Information Through the Ages, and several other authors of books as I wind my way through some of the new and really fascinating books that are coming out today. Eric Davis, the author of a book on California mysticism, will also be on. So you can always find this show through several avenues. The first is by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find the show as well as all previous shows. You can also go to the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society by typing Center for Internet and Society into the search engine in iTunes. And lastly, you can subscribe to the podcast feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. That's Stanford CIS's website. So thank you again for listening to Hearsay Culture here on KZSU. Please stay tuned for more programming on the station. I will look forward to talking to you next week.